Case 8, and that is Rayburn v. Cigna Life Insurance. Mr. Dubofsky, good morning. Still morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent the plaintiff, Edward Rayburn. Mr. Rayburn underwent 4 surgeries, treatment with a pain specialist, pursued a Social Security disability claim with the assistance of Cigna's representative, Advantage 2000, received the unequivocal opinions of his treating doctor, Dr. Sage, that he remained disabled, yet the district court found that Cigna did not abuse its discretion in terminating Mr. Rayburn's benefits.
Can you tell me this? Are you essentially arguing that only the underlying insurance policy can be considered in determining the terms of the ERISA plan? Because that, of course, would be, well, would it be, if that is your argument, inconsistent with consideration of other documents such as, you know, Semien?
It's a very confusing question, and I'm sure this Court is absolutely sick of dealing with these standard of review issues in ERISA. But I think that this case is a logical development following the Court's prior decision, particularly in the Schwartz versus Prudential case. But it's perhaps a little easier in this case, and without directly addressing Your Honor's question, I think if we take a look at the particular document that's at issue here, which the Court relied on in granting discretion, this The claim fiduciary appointment.
It's never given to Rayburn until litigation. Is that the one?
Correct. Even though we had requested it twice during the final claim appeal, it was never produced until immediately prior to the filing of summary judgment. But the defect in this document, or the defects in this document, are manifest. First of all, it identifies the L3 Communications Health and Welfare Plan, yet in the summary plan description the defendant filed with the court, document 39-3 at page 21 of 23, there's a different plan name. It identifies a plan administrator, the Benefit Plan Committee, L3 Communications Corporation. Same document has a different plan administrator named. The document indicates that the plan administrator hereby applies to the claim fiduciary for amendments to its policies, yet there was no amendment. Page 1046 of the record shows that Cigna knew how to effect an amendment. That page represents an amendment to the policy. There was no amendment made to this policy. And for this document to stand alone, particularly since at the very bottom left-hand corner, it indicates must be executed by a person authorized to amend the plan, we have no idea if the person who signed this document was authorized. And in fact, the so-called plan document in the file is missing numerous pages, and we don't even know what the proper amendment procedure is. So for the court to simply accept the defendant's representation that this document was sufficient to confer discretionary authority when the defendant's sloppy draftsmanship and sloppy procedural conduct did not clearly give discretion to Cigna, we believe was reversible error. But turning to the merits, as the court noted in a footnote, this decision came out almost immediately after the Supreme Court issued the MetLife versus Glenn decision last June. And the court indicated that the decision was issued after the Glenn decision, it was issued after the Glenn decision had come out, but it was prepared prior to the Glenn decision. And then the court indicated that the Glenn decision didn't make any difference.
But the court did that twice, didn't it, also in the motion to reconsider?
That's correct.
Which obviously would have come after a little bit more time for reflection on Glenn.
But if this court takes a look at Glenn, as it has to do conducting a de novo review of the district court summary judgment ruling, the Glenn case raises a number of issues that the district court just completely ignored, either in its initial decision or in denying our motion for reconsideration. For instance, the court never even mentioned the conflict of interest, which the Supreme Court said in Glenn must be considered in every case in which the arbitrary and capricious standard is applied. a key focus of the Glenn ruling was the fact that the insurance company had assisted the claimant in obtaining Social Security disability benefits, yet disregarded that award when Ms. Glenn's benefits were terminated.
Glenn certainly doesn't say that there's always a conflict of interest. Could you explain why you think the conflict of interest that Glenn was talking about exists here as well?
It's the identical conflict of interest. It's the inherent conflict of interest by virtue of the fact that the insurance company is in the structural position of being both the plan administrator or the de facto plan administrator as well as the source of benefit funding.
So that's going to be the case every time a company decides to use an insurance company to manage its plans.
That's correct. However, in the world of ERISA, the court's well aware that there are many plans, primarily pension plans, that are set up as funded trusts where the trust is completely separate from the plan sponsor. And that way you can eliminate the conflict that you have in a case such as this. But it's completely uneliminated in this situation. And then besides this...
So if the district court had found a conflict of interest, is it your notion that Glenn then requires just a more searching standard of review?
It requires more consideration of the underlying record than merely looking to see whether the decision is downright unreasonable,
exactly what I'm saying then.
Right.
So you think Glenn means that there's some perhaps intermediate standard of review between de novo, just do it all over again, and is it downright unreasonable at the other end of the spectrum?
I wish the Supreme Court had been more clear about that issue. The Supreme Court's conclusions with respect to that issue are entirely unclear. But what the court did indicate is that where there is a conflict of interest, the lower courts are to consider a combination of factors, which would include an issue such as the one here where the insurance company assisted the claimant in applying for Social Security and then recouped the benefit of it.
Why do you think that should be relevant? I mean, I'm not worried actually here about the fact that the standards under Social Security are somewhat different, because nobody says that your client got his Social Security benefit because he fit in a particular listing or because he was a certain age or any of these things that are actually different under Social Security. But why should it matter that Cigna was helping him with his Social Security claim?
Because, as this court previously pointed out in the Ladd versus ITT case, you have a situation where the insurance company's agent is advocating to the Social Security Administration, this individual is totally disabled and cannot perform any work at all. Yet at the same time, the insurance company is saying to Mr. Glenn, Mr. Rayburn in this case,
we're
going to totally disregard the Social Security decision. In fact, on page 878 of the record, Cigna wrote to Mr. Rayburn saying, we give no consideration whatsoever to the Social Security decision.
A form of judicial estoppel somehow? I'm wondering how this fits in.
That's what this court indicated in the Ladd case, that it's not judicial estoppel per se, but falls within the penumbra of the principle of judicial estoppel. And this case is a perfect example. Cigna had paid Mr. Rayburn $34,000, and they recouped $27,000. And as the court said in Ladd, they didn't just want to lighten the load, they wanted to eliminate it altogether, which was particularly striking to the court as it was to the Supreme Court in the Glenn case. I'll reserve
before
the rest.
Sit down,
I'll give you another minute.
Suppose we agreed with you about everything. I mean, about this procedural stuff. My other question is, how strong a case does Mr. Rayburn have in the final analysis? Is this a borderline case?
There's two ways to look at that, Your Honor. I would submit that worst-case scenario for Mr. Rayburn is that the evidence in this case is in complete equipoise. When you weigh Dr. Player's opinion and the inscrutable two sentences or whatever that the two in-house doctors at Cigna wrote against the opinions of Dr. Sage and Social Security, worst-case, equipoise. And then under the tiebreaker in Glenn, the tie should go to Mr. Rayburn. But if you look at the quantity and quality of the evidence presented, which is a repeated theme in the Sixth Circuit cases and in the original Glenn versus MetLife decision, it was repeated there as well, if you look at the quality and quantity of the evidence and you look at the entire record, from the context of this record, the only compelled conclusion is that Mr. Rayburn is entitled to benefits.
Thank you. Mr. Swofford, good morning.
Your Honor, excuse me. Steve Swofford on behalf of the Cigna Life Insurance Company of New York. We believe, of course, the district court properly held that there was a deferential standard of review and that Cigna's decision was not arbitrary and capricious. I want to clear up some things about the plan. You know, in this case, the plan is basically an insurance policy and the appointment of the claim fiduciary.
But there are requirements for amending plans. I mean, the plan can't be the summary plan description. There's got to be a plan that's being summarized in the summary plan description.
No, but I mean, in the court in Semien said this is like a common situation where you have documents that aren't even labeled a plan, and it's just a series of documents, so there's still the plan.
But at some point, that's a real problem under ERISA because people have to have notice of the plan.
But notice is not a problem in this case. Your Honor.
Well, to you, perhaps.
Well, no, Mr. Dabowski just said.
There's a summary plan description that specifically refers to this appointment. Okay.
How are they supposed to know what the appointment says if they can't? They've never seen it.
At the same time, it says that fiduciary responsibility. Well, let me not do it from memory, if I can find it.
You're talking about page
3, I believe, or maybe not.
The place under plan administration where it says the plan administrator has delegated to the insurance company, et cetera, et cetera. I think that is on the third page. And then there's another thing that says the actual provisions of the plan are set forth in the insurance policy and claims fiduciary agreement between L3 and Cigna. But
there
nobody
is
knows what these things say.
And if he never even received the Employee Welfare Benefit Plan appointment of claim fiduciary until the litigation was underway, how can we hold that that document defined the terms of the plan?
Well, he had the SPD, which put him on notice of the discretionary authority of the claims administrator.
But the problem is that the SPD can't contradict the underlying plan. The problem is that the SPD, which I agree with you, says that, is not entitled to contradict the terms of the underlying plan. And it's my understanding that until this appointment of claim fiduciary form was produced, the underlying plan didn't clearly say that there was full discretion, as we understand it. You need this document. In other words, you need this appointment of claim fiduciary.
We need this document. No question about that.
Yeah. Okay.
It was a separate contract between, I mean, you know, this is like a contract between Cigna and L3. And he was entitled to the document if he requested it. He said he requested it in the administrative hearing. I don't remember seeing anything in the record to that effect. If he requested it and didn't get it, there are provisions under the ERISA where, you know, there can be penalties against the plan. But he's not here seeking penalties. We're here as to whether or not this is a plan document and whether it delegated discretionary authority to Cigna to decide the claim.
You know, on another front, the district court didn't appear to properly consider the structural conflict here, you know, with Cigna advocating a disability finding before the SSA and then rejecting it when it impacted its own pocketbook. After the Supreme Court's decision in Glenn, shouldn't that have been treated as a serious concern in weighing the role of structural conflicts in Cigna's decision? And shouldn't we just remand for the district court to properly consider it, as many other circuit courts have done in similar cases?
Well, number one, the district court did consider it, maybe not as much as you wanted it to suggest.
Yeah, in a footnote with very little analysis.
I don't believe that's The Social Security decision?
The Glenn.
Glenn.
The district
Glenn.
Court.
Oh, I'm
the
sorry,
district
Glenn.
Court. We're talking about the district court that has to balance.
I thought you were asking about the Social Security decision, but you're asking about putting
words
together.
We're talking about Glenn and how Glenn is supposed to
be. I'm sorry?
How Glenn is supposed to be applied. And the district court just made a passing reference in a footnote and didn't deal with the structural conflict issue.
Just give me a second to say what the facts were, because in the facts of this case, there had been two Social Security determinations denying benefits at the time that Cigna denied benefits. Social Security Administration ultimately reversed itself. All right? When it reversed itself, for instance, it didn't consider the independent medical exam of Dr. Player.
There's a good reason for that.
What?
What?
I'm sorry?
He didn't give much, if any, consideration to the impact of Rayburn's pain and his pain medications on his ability.
He has a 20-page report here, Your Honor, with little 8 or 6-point type in which he reviews the history. He does pain tests. He does an examination. I just beg to differ with that. And ultimately, and I don't want to run out of time, ultimately, Dr. Sage has no problem with the examination. He just has a problem with the conclusion about disability. And the difference between Dr. Player's finding that Rayburn can do sedentary a job is not much different than what the Social Security Administrator held in finding 5, where he found that Dr. Rayburn would have been able to work 7 hours a day, but he couldn't quite make that last hour threshold. I mean, the differences between the two are, as far as the fact that he wasn't disabled, are not that great, and this is a rational decision. If it's if the Cigna is entitled to any difference at all in its decision, it has an independent medical exam by a third party not employed by Cigna, which details more evidence than whatever was submitted to the Social Security Administration.
See, Dr. Player felt that Rayburn didn't act like he was in great pain during the examination.
He did these pain tests, and I'm not a doctor, so I can't tell you what these pain tests are. Okay, Your Honor. I'm sorry, doctor. But he did pain.
There are two of us up here married to doctors. That makes us doctors.
Oh, my. Okay, well.
No.
Fear not.
That's outside the record, right?
And are well trained to defer to records.
So. there's just nothing on the face of this 20-page independent medical evaluation which did address, it did specifically address the question of pain and found that there was pain magnification, and ultimately all it found was that Rayburn could have a sedentary job, which is the standard after the 2 years, that is unreasonable. I mean, that's just not my bottom line on Dr. Blair.
You know, it is nearly impossible to prove the degree of pain that someone experiences, other than to point out that it's consistent with the physical impairment at issue. And I don't know. I just didn't think that either Dr. Player or Dr. Seifert, regardless of how many pages, that provided, you know, a real basis for disregarding his claims of pain. But this is a very close case in my mind.
I would just, if I could, you know, comment on that statement. The only thing in your finding with the plaintiff's own doctors who are going to be, you know, have their own biases, is what they feel or his subjective his pain is. They didn't do the pain tests that Dr. Player did. I mean, I know, I understand what you're saying, that pain is a tough question, but it's got to be resolved somehow medically, and the only doctor that approached it through medical tests was Dr. Player.
Well, of course, you have got Dr. Sage, who performed, you know, the third and fourth surgeries.
But there's my point was that Dr. Player has these tests, whatever they are, they're referred to at page. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what page, and I'm not going to lose the time, but to just because it's only 20 pages. But he did specifically use some objective tests. I mean, that's my point, and, you know, I hope it works. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dabowski, how much time does Miss... You have a minute. Really?
Unless the court has any questions.
No?
No.
Okay. So unusual. Thank you for that extra minute. Thank you to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.